Hey, everybody. Welcome to This Week in Pre-IPO Stocks. With me, I got Nick Fusco, CEO of AFU, a pre-IPO secondary market pricing company, and Evan Cohen, co-founder and COO, of Vincent.com. It's a media company focused on alternative investments. All right, fellas. Chime. So Chime came out this week and said that they are looking to IPO. Chris Britt, who's their CEO, said that they could not be in a better place internally as a company to go public. Their last round was in September of 2021 at $25 billion, and their most recent round is at $4.5 billion. That's 82% down. That's a big difference, right? So Chime, of course, is a neobank. They serve as kind of the underbanked community, right? So I guess, first of all, thoughts on Chime, or maybe investment case on Chime? Nick, maybe I'll kick it off to you first, right? What are your thoughts on that business?
Yeah, it's super, super interesting to see a lot of the growth in these neobanks, some of which have a bit stalled. Really, when you look at Chime, the revenues from 2018, this is from Priority Data, was 80 million, then 200, then 600, then 950, 1.8 billion, 3.1 in 2023. So, I mean, the pace of growth here is pretty explosive. But if they're not going to hit those numbers on an ongoing basis, that's usually a good signal for the CEO to say, hey, let's bring it to IPO. Let's get some retail investment. In my eyes, that could be, this is the ultimate bag holder would be retail. So maybe the private market is giving an indication of that. But that being said, we just saw the IPO of Reddit, clearly not in the banking sector.
Yeah.
That was really downtrodden in the secondary market, and it did brilliantly with the IPO. But I would say the growth story is something that Chime could get behind, at least on the revenue figures, more so than the valuations.
Okay, fair enough. So Evan, what do you think about Chime?
You know, it's an interesting story. You know, Chime has really been, they've been one of the biggest names in neobanking since the trend took off like 7 years ago. You know, we do have a couple of comparable public comps. So there's obviously SoFi and Dave, which both are trading, and they have actually, right, both of those companies had inverse narratives. SoFi has really struggled in the last year. Their stock is down significantly. At the other end, Dave is doing exceptionally well. And I agree with Nick. The growth story is quite compelling. That said, like, the entire banking sector has sort of experienced an up and down volatility over the last year. And I think it's a very competitive space. And I know that a lot of the neobanks and the regular banks, they make their money in lending. And I don't know if Dave's customer base is really, there's enough revenue opportunity in TAM to be competitive in the places that can really make high margin. And so, personally, I'm not a buyer. I don't think that the neobank businesses are technology businesses. I think that they are financial services businesses. And that when people try to slap a technology company layer on businesses that historically don't have technology business models or technology margins, over time, the truth ends up coming out and the companies do end up repricing where they should be.
So it's interesting. I know one of us on this call has great experience with SoFi.
Yeah.
And if I just quickly run some comparable numbers, SoFi's at something like a revenue to valuation multiple of 3.5. We're like half of that when you look at something like Chime, though. So in that case, it's super, super compelling, right? And on a multiple basis, just we'd have to line up a whole lot more banks that are of that ilk and size. But it seems to be trading at a pretty big discount.
I know more about this space than I probably would like to admit, right? This payment space. But, you know, Chime and Dave are both like interchange-based type businesses, right? So interchange is like every time you swipe a card, you get, you know, like Chime gets a piece of that revenue, right? They don't really do lending at all. It's a tough business, right? Especially when you're paying so much to acquire new customers. So unless you can kind of crack that code or get this like more of like a flywheel type scenario in there where you're cross selling, it's a tough business. But that being said, I will say that revenue multiple is interesting. Fintech has just taken it on the chin in general, like over the last 2 years, right? It's just gotten smoked and it hasn't come back. And now you got this AI narrative and crypto's back and like fintech's just like an afterthought for a lot of people, right? So it'd be interesting. I agree with you. I think like a lot of these companies are just like financial services companies, right? And they use technology instead of having like bank branches. So some like inherent benefit to the operations, but I'm not quite sure if it scales in the same way. And then, of course, financial services is really, and I hate to say this, but it's true. It's for wealthier people. And that's really where, if you're a financial services company, that's where you make your money, right? You just got a loan and to lend money, people have to have great balance sheets and high credit scores. And that's just not traditionally where a lot of the fintechs play, right? They play in kind of the lower net worth or kind of lower income type demographic, right? So it's a tough one. But look, if you do have to pick one, though, there's really like Chime and Revolut. That's the other name that's big. And that's a European-focused business. They have some operations in the U.S. But in Europe, there's kind of a different use case because banking's a little disjointed over there, right? And then, of course, you have multiple currencies. You have the British pound, you got the euro, you got Swiss franc, right? So there's some interesting, like, other additional services that can be provided in the European market that doesn't really apply to the U.S. market where fintechs can add some value. If I'm like taking a position in the pre-IPO market, I'm looking at Revolut, I think, versus Chime. Okay, let's switch gears to CoreWeave. Okay, so CoreWeave is a cloud provider. They specifically focus on GPUs, right? But they did a secondary transaction last December, so just a couple months ago, at a $7 billion valuation. And now they're looking to raise, this is rumor, at a $16 billion valuation. That is a big jump. So PitchBook has these guys with the 2024 revenue forecast. I'm not sure how PitchBook came up with that, but I'm going with it. At $1.5 billion. So that's a 10.7x multiple. PitchBook had 2023 revenue at $600 million. So what are your guys' thoughts on – maybe, Evan, we can start with you, right? What do you think about CoreWeave?
Yeah, there's a number of red flags that I just want to, like, put out there. I'm not sure if you guys know, but, like, for one, the December transaction was a secondary transaction. It wasn't a primary offering. Some internal holder decided to sell shares, which whether that was one of the founders or executive or even some early investors, that is red flag number one. You got a company that's, you know, riding the tail of like, an amazingly big opportunity and people are selling this early. So red flag number one. Number two, which I actually think is a red flag, but in a lot of ways could be a benefit to the company in the long run, is they have this partnership with NVIDIA where NVIDIA is giving them preference over GPUs compared to AWS and Azure and Google because they're not competing. Like those other platforms, yeah. Amazon.
NVIDIA also is an investor into CoreWeave too. So there's a little bit of that inside baseball.
But yeah. Like Amazon and Google, they're known to be trying to compete with NVIDIA and create their own GPU chips or their own silicon. And CoreWeave is not. So, you know, if you're NVIDIA sitting there saying, well, do I want to arm my competitors or do I want to arm someone who's perfectly aligned with me? And now I'm an investor and cap table investor with, makes a lot of sense. The fact that they're powering Microsoft is incredibly interesting. I do think that, and you know, I don't know if you know this, this business was started in 2017 by some dudes that wanted to, they were commodities traders that wanted to do Ethereum mining. Yeah. And they totally pivoted the business into this like massive opportunity and are crushing it. There's a lot of like narrative violations when I think about the company that make me a little concerned, but the whole entire space is a giant red flag. So I guess if you're bullish on NVIDIA and you're just like, NVIDIA is the play, whatever they do, I'm with, this is a great opportunity. And I think that's a pretty strong thesis, frankly.
Got it. Nick, I don't know a lot about these guys. I don't know if you do either, right? But I mean, like, what do you know about CoreWeave? Do you have any data on them? Are they trading in the secondary right now?
Yeah, so we clocked the Series B early 2023 at $2.5 billion or so. And now they're trading up around that secondary transaction number.
$7 billion.
Yeah, but we really, I mean, we talked a lot about on this podcast on the picks and shovels, who's going to dominate. And I'm always drawing back to the companies that are in this universe. You definitely want exposure to, you want to have asset allocation within the private space, no matter what, but the big winners are going to be your store and compute players. So your Amazon and Google and Microsoft, right? But this is a differentiated compute platform really benefiting all the growth in the AI space. So in terms of like the GPU units that they're getting, it's freaking massive. Maybe this is the underdog. If you don't want to go to Meta, Google, Amazon for some of that, CoreWeave is going to be a really good solution for you. They're kind of nestled between on a global scale, like a Tencent and a Baidu in terms of that delivery. So I think this is kind of cool. they would definitely be more of your underdog, but the revenue growth is outrageous. And yeah, maybe this was a sleeper for a while. They started doing something, as Evan said, for Ethereum mining, and then you end up here. I think maybe they were just in the right place at the right time, and that dynamic with NVIDIA is outrageous.
And this is what I'm going to ask my developer buddies about this, because I want to know if these guys have some kind of unique value proposition on how they're offering their cloud services or the way they're able to deliver those services versus just having access to GPUs, right? So, because I would have to imagine access to GPUs as kind of the core value proposition would have to eventually go away at some point, or maybe they just get acquired. But I don't know if you're gonna get acquired at a massive multiple. Maybe you do, but I don't, that seems like if that's the only thing you got, you know, and the people acquiring you are the ones that are your customers. I don't know if you're getting a huge premium for that, right?
That can go in any direction. I mean, look at Dell's recent spike, right? They've got the servers to blast through this stuff, and people didn't really realize that. Showed in their earnings report, and it was like, whoa, thing was up.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there are a bunch of these companies on the, well, they're definitely not on the sidelines. They're front and center, but they're not getting all the attention until their revenue numbers come out, and it's 1,000+% up. And that's exactly the case with these guys.
Well, so, I met a fellow the other day, guys, did like an SPV into these folks for a big number, like in an early round. So I hope it just launches for this fellow so he makes a ton of money, because that would be really cool. And he was a nice guy, right? So I hope that happens for him, man. It's super interesting. And then, Nick, to your point, the primary round was even lower than that, right? To Evan's point, there's a secondary trade was the $7 billion thing. So that if it's $2 billion-ish, $3 billion-ish to $16 billion, that's nuts. That's huge. That's a huge jump, right? So I hope it happens for them. That'd be great. Look,
if they're doing $1.5 billion in revenue, that's what, a little more than a 10x on.
It's 10.7x. Yeah.
It's not totally out of line, but I guess just, you know, the broader narrative of these other founders who've started AI companies like Inflection or whatever, selling to Microsoft. The idea of a massive secondary transaction for a company that has all of like the tailwinds behind them of a big paradigm shift in technology just seems a little strange to me. Like, that's sure. $570 million secondary transaction. That's a huge deal.
Sure, I know. But there's a lot of reasons why folks, I mean, maybe if somebody's trying to raise their next fund, so they're trying to show DPI, and you know what I mean? This is like one they can take off the table. There's like a whole bunch of, I could see how people could jump. I actually don't know. I don't know how much that trade was. I could probably look it up real quick.
I think they said it was $570 million at a 16, or at a 7, 570 at a 7 billion.
So like, Yeah. Like so that, it does look like it was one investor, right?
Yeah.
So,
and was it FTX? And
we don't know if they exactly. were involved directly, but you've got JP Morgan and Fidelity all marking around this number more recently.
So, 7.
Yeah. So that's pretty interesting
Yeah. Well, they were in that round, Nick. They were in that round at 7. So I bet they're just marking it at where they bought it at.
At the cost. But,
okay. All right. Let's talk Boom. So Boom is a plane company, all right? They make supersonic passenger jets. And just this past week, they had a successful test flight of their plane. So the whole kick here is that supersonic flight, it's like half the time. So if you want to go to like New York to London, it's half the time that it would normally take on a regular commercial flight. I did kind of like putz about and see if I could find out how much this would cost. It looks like a New York to London is like $5,000 on Boom. That's like the price of a first class ticket. So here's the thing. You guys taking a supersonic flight to save 3 hours? Like, what do you think?
I just want to play off your use of the word putt there, because this is
putz
just
about.
Just fun fact. Olaza Bell, on the 1999 Ryder Cup team, did the world's longest putt on board the Concorde, right? The Concorde's the clear parallel to Boom Supersonic here. The longest putt was done at a speed of 1,270 miles per hour, and it was said to have traveled 9.2 miles. So that is the longest putt ever recorded. So love your word choice there.
I love that.
But hell yeah, if I could beat the world record for the longest putt and be up there,
I think that's amazing. I mean, you guys know I did a lot of my time and career in the UK. That back and forth, it wears on you. Being able to do that in 3 hours is amazing. Maybe not nowadays when you're going to spend 2 hours sitting at the airport with security and then 45 minutes on the other side, which is still really annoying. But doing that flight in 3 hours is amazing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, what do you think, Adam? You fly in a plane? You fly in one of these?
I mean, I certainly would use it. To Nick's point earlier, it's like the Concorde existed for many years. It's interesting because, you know, we had this technology 3 decades ago, and it wasn't efficient back then. It was expensive, and probably today I think there's more disposable income in the regular market. So maybe today it makes more sense to spend $5,000 on a flight versus maybe back in 1989 it wasn't really as functional. You know, I haven't heard about this company since they were in Y Combinator in 2015. And I remember sitting there being like, wow, there's an airplane startup that's going through a software accelerator in the Valley. It's just amazing that this country can produce entrepreneurs who are willing to take such massive leaps and bets and build such innovative technologies, knowing that they're competing against massive $100 billion companies like Boeing and Airbus. So applaud the entrepreneurs and all of the people that worked at that company that figured out how to build an airplane, a supersonic jet, which is just pretty amazing.
I got to tell you, man, like, so you got, like, Boeing's a disaster now. The CEO is just out. That got announced this morning, right? And then Airbus has been around. But there's really nobody that makes, like, big passenger jets anymore. I mean, you have Embraer, right, which is a Brazilian company. They make a lot of the smaller jets, right?
Yeah,
but, I mean,
Learjet,
it's like
Gulfstream.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, like, I'm thinking, like, Delta flights, United Airlines, like, where do they buy their planes from? And it's Boeing and it's Airbus. So it'd be nice to have a third company in there, and certainly one that's more, like, I would say, technology-focused and efficiency-focused as opposed to, you know, chock full of unions and legacy stuff, you know what I mean, that just, like just ruins the innovation of what it could be, right? I mean, planes haven't changed in a long time.
Absolutely.
It would be nice to get some improvements, improvements, right?
So as I said, there were supersonic jets in the past. And the reason why I believe that they discontinued them or discontinued that service is because they weren't profitable, right? Like, jet fuel was super expensive. There were expensive taxes. The planes themselves had high maintenance, and they weren't able to hold enough passengers to make the juice worth the squeeze. I still wonder if that's the case today. Like, I don't think jet fuel has gotten cheaper. I don't think that, I mean, maybe passengers are willing to pay slightly more. But to Nick's point, you know, we also have an entire new market of private flyers. You look at the NetJets, the people that are flying private, and who say, you know what, I'll take an extra hour or two of my flight if it means that I get to fly in a PJ. So I wonder if there is really product market fit for it. So I think it's really interesting that this offering will be available potentially to consumers. I have hesitation that I think this is like a Boeing disruptor, although would love to see that because flying on Boeing airplanes today is frightening. You know, I even when the company came out in 2015, I was like, we've had this technology, but where's the innovation? And I haven't seen that yet. So I'm curious.
All right. And Nick, any last kind of parting thoughts on Boom?
I think it needs to be resurrected like the Phoenix that it is. So, I mean, One thing that will not be forgotten, I mean, when we're talking about the Boeing CEO stepping down, a lot of mishaps in the air that are and have been occurring. The same thing happened with Concorde in 2000, and then it was later retired by both Air France and BA in 2003. So I think a lot could be learned in I guess that's 2 decades there to advance that. And then from a business case, Aaron, I would just echo all of your comments about being able to start fresh and be a younger, more nimble company with great minds that don't have to work within the confines of a big institution. I bet the strides they've been able to make are just exceptional. So I would definitely see this as a good competitor that I would love to see remain independent for as long as possible rather than being acquired by one of those two companies or another.
That's right. But, well, like SpaceX, Anduril, those are two good examples, right, of the same thing that you're talking about, right, Nick? You know, this is just obviously in commercial airlines.
Right, and even Virgin. So Virgin Galactic, funnily enough, I mean, they've created some incredible technology, and maybe that becomes an outlet for this. Who knows? I mean, a lot of folks are focused on space, but this could be really the next thing to get over, because this is much more commercially viable than putting people into orbit and letting them take selfies, right? This is
for sure.
This is something that everyone could use. Well, not everyone.
I'm more of the opinion.
But the people that are involved in the high-end baking.
Right? Yeah. 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 I mean, I'm more of the opinion that Boom's going to be competing with Apple Vision Pro and augmented reality, right, in the very near future. That to me is going to, I think, cut in a big way into business travel. I know somebody mentioned Nancy Pelosi earlier before the call, right? Sorry. So any parting thoughts? Nancy's big trade into Databricks, True Social, de-SPACing, right? I mean, any thoughts on any of those two topics?
I think the Nancy trade is amazing. So I love every once in a while something pops up on the radar and says that she bought calls on NVIDIA, yeah. Right?
She's very good.
Yeah, she's
a very good investor.
I think a lot of people can't time the market, but some people are just better than others, particularly yeah. with Congress behind them. But I think the fact that Nancy has extended some of her trading activity into private markets is actually just a very good thing and a good signal that this is a viable asset class yeah. for everyone.
Nick,
if anyone was going to have
enough opportunity. There's not enough opportunity in the public Correct. Markets anymore, right? For Nancy, Correct. She's got to go private. She's got to go to private, right?
So who knows what's going to happen with Databricks? I'm sure you're not going to be buying it if there's bad news on the horizon.
But I love it.
I think this is a really good fundamental observation of what's occurring that the general public should be focused on.
You know what I love, Nick? You know what I love about this too? She bought through a Forge SPV. Right. Which I think is like I just think that's the best. It wasn't even like, you know, I knew somebody and I like, you know, had some inside track to the executive team at date. She just rocked right into the Forge so SPV. Trade.
There you go.
Like everybody else did. And I'm sure she might have, I mean, who knows what price she got, but she might have got her face ripped off on that trade too. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see how she does. I'm sure we'll end up getting a updated report. So it'd be interesting to see. Well, they're marking that over time.
I think some of it is public. They won't.
Nancy, what do you think, Evan? Any thoughts on?
I mean, I there are a couple of apps that I mentioned earlier that you can copy trade Nancy Pelosi, which I think is pretty interesting. And the same people that you could copy like Inverse Kramer and Pete, you know, these effectively meme investors. But yeah, she's been incredibly successful. I think it's consensus that Databricks is an excellent company, and I think IPO, it's going to do well. So
yes, look,
I don't think that this is like the most like, you know, amazing trade that I've ever seen, but I agree with Nick that the fact that she's doing it and her track record of pretty much doing pretty well just is just more strength that when that Databricks IPO comes out, it's going to be that will be one that's worth putting cash behind.
Well, it's not interesting until like you hear about the big government announcement that they just signed like a $5 billion deal with Databricks in like 2 months time. Right? That's where it gets interesting.
That's where it gets interesting. I mean, but I also don't think it necessarily matters if this trade returns negative 10, positive 10, or positive 10x. I think the fact that she's done it.
Oh, I hear you.
It is the big important aspect of things,
sure.
of things, right?
Yeah, 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 you know, yeah, yeah.
That's what you want to see more family offices, RIAs, individual investors, high net worth, just really anyone accredited being involved here. Because I've said it far too many times about the asset allocation. It's like when you go to someone or you have 100 people in a room and you ask how many people are exposed to crypto, love it or hate
sure.
it.
Sure. Fair
that
point.
Question gets a different answer today than it did 5 years ago and 10 years ago.
You're right.
This
You're
is the right. same the same thing. So I think.
Well, not for nothing. I mean, Databricks is a $49 billion valuation, right? So it's not like, and it's profitable and it's growing really fast. It's not like it's,
right. so it would
it's
land,
like two kids in a garage, right?
Right. It would land in a number of the massive ETFs immediately. Tomorrow if it was public, right? Yeah, it's a big name.
Well, also just Nick, to counter your point though, for just 1 second, like, I think it's a little ironic that, you know, this isn't a stock that's available for everybody. She's buying it before every American can buy it. It's almost like unfair, unlike crypto, which is like, hey, how many people in the room own crypto? Like anyone can go create a Coinbase account and go buy crypto. Not everybody can go buy Dataplex. So it's like the opposite. Well, she's like,
that's the SEC's fault, not her fault, right? And well, it's not even, I shouldn't say it that way. That's not nice to say to the SEC. It's just like, you know, there's just, you know, there's an accredited investor rule. If that wasn't there, a lot more people I think would own it, you know?
But Congress can pass rules against that.
You know, that is true. And that's true. You're not wrong about that.
Institutions like yours, Aaron, that could go out and produce an SPV for this, right? It could be purpose built for Databricks, or it could be exposed to the top 10 stocks out there.
You could crowdfund around it. It'd be a little expensive, but you could do it. Yep. Yeah.
Getting easier, and the technology is there. So yeah. You know, I mean, 10 years ago, it would have been a little bit harder maybe to get your Ethereum and your Bitcoin than it is today, where there are 100 apps that'll do it for you. Same thing goes for these private shares.
You're not wrong about this. But Nick, like the one thing too, and I talk about this with advisors all the time, is that, you know, these companies are huge. Like Databricks is a $49 billion valuation company. That, I mean, the cutoff to go from Russell 2000 to Russell 1000, I just looked at it this morning, is 4.2 billion market cap, right? So this company is like firmly in like the S&P 500, right? If it was public. So, I mean, if you think about this, and I talk about this with advisors all the time, like,
to that end, yeah, there you go.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, like if you think about it, like these companies normally would have gone public like at a $1 billion valuation, and then they'd be in the Russell 2000, and they work their way up through the Russell 2, and you get all that benefit there, and then they pop into the Russell 1, and you get all the benefit there, right? Like the Amazons of the world and the Metas and all these other places, right? You know, like that didn't happen. That's not happening here. Right. So, you know, you got to. To your point, Nick, like if you really want U.S. equity exposure and you want those kind of like the next emerging group of technology companies, you got to have private market exposure or you're missing out. By the time you get it in the public markets, all of the value will have been past you. You're on the other side of it, right? So a lot to be said for that. It's interesting too, though, Nick, too, like when I talk to advisors, a lot of advisors don't even know the names. They don't even know these companies, right? So it's really interesting. It's like very interesting.
It's changing.
Yeah, that's changing fast, because when you pick up the newspaper, more and more these are your first five pages of news, which is good.
Fair enough. Fair point. All right, fellas, let's end it there. I appreciate you guys, and I will see you next week. All right. Have a good